In October, hundreds of African Americans took to the streets of St. Petersburg, Florida, after the killing of a black suspect by a white police officer at a traffic stop. A month later, when a grand jury exonerated the police officer, more violence broke out. In all, more than 60 homes and businesses were burned and dozens of people were injured. After the riots, the Clinton administration promised the city $20 million in federal aid, and members of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights returned to St. Petersburg. 4 years before, they had given the city, the fourth largest in Florida, a failing grade in race relations. As NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports, the recent events have highlighted racial divisions that go back decades.
St. Petersburg, on Florida's west coast, beckons to pleasure seekers with miles of public beaches, year-round sunshine, and attractions such as its landmark pier, a quarter-mile-long promenade at the edge of downtown. It's capped with a five-story inverted glass pyramid containing restaurants, shops, and an aquarium featuring the underwater inhabitants of Tampa Bay.
Yeah, what kind of fish is that?
It's a flounder.
And why is he laying like that, do you know?
The
hot fish. Right.
St. Petersburg's primary product has been its image as a casual and tranquil setting for young families and retirees alike. For aquarium visitors like Norma Drake, the two nights of rioting in October and November did little to alter that wholesome image.
Not being here all year round, I really don't have a strong opinion about it. That's about all I can say. I think it's sad that we have to have problems like that.
Drake is among thousands of residents who divide their year between St. Petersburg and somewhere else. For her, the somewhere else is Solon Springs, Wisconsin. The seasonal population is a source of prosperity and publicity for St. Petersburg, but it's also one of many elements that contribute to divisions between the city's white and black communities, says Raymond Arsenault. He's a professor at the University of South Florida and author of A History of St. Petersburg, one of the first cities to hire its own public relations agent in 1918.
There was a consistent, you know, attempt to differentiate St. Petersburg from the stereotypic or the typical southern city. They wanted to portray St. Petersburg as a subtropical playground, a kind of paradise. They didn't want people to think about Birmingham, Alabama or Jackson, Mississippi. So you have this attempt to create an image of the city as comfortable and safe and white, and yet much of the hard work and the labor was done by African Americans.
In the past, Arsenault says, promotional literature downplayed how many African Americans lived in St. Petersburg, indicating there was only a small colored section when the actual population was closer to 25%. Today it's about 19%. Because many of those residents live in the city year-round and have done so for generations longer than many white families, much of St. Petersburg's historical memory resides with them.
This is a city where you had no access to the beaches. This is a city that passed an ordinance saying that black people could not live past a certain place, Fifth Avenue South. Then it was down to 18th, then it was down to 15th, then all the way down to 22nd, and finally the ordinance didn't make any sense. But we were barred. If you did.
Peggy Peterman, a retired reporter and columnist for the St. Petersburg Times, chronicled the city's racial history for 35 years. Earlier this month, she led reporters visiting the Poynter Institute for Media Studies on a tour of African American neighborhoods. A multi-lane expressway stands between those neighborhoods and downtown, and much of the black-owned commerce that once thrived there has vanished. Despite some city-sponsored beautification programs, black residents claim that city services remain separate and unequal. Some even swear the streetlights in their neighborhoods are dimmer than those in white areas. But they are angriest, Peggy Peterman says, about the police, who shot six black motorists this year. The last of them, 18-year-old Tyron Lewis, died behind the wheel of a car police suspected he'd stolen. The history of animosity between blacks and police is a long one, Peterman says.
I've heard them call folks nigger. I've seen it. I've seen brutality. I watched a black woman bloody from the top of her head all the way down, running down 16th Street, trying to stop a police car. The police car came toward her, saw her, and kept going.
In decades past, historians say police used intimidation and arrests to keep St. Petersburg's blacks in the place assigned to them by whites. That history surfaced in city politics 4 years ago. That's when former police chief Ernest Kurt Kurtzinger ran for mayor. Kurtzinger came from the Los Angeles Police Department and reportedly tried to apply some of its more notorious methods in his Florida job. He narrowly lost the election, despite support from most white voters. The present mayor, David Fisher, was elected with 95% of the black vote. Kurtzinger's campaign, Peggy Peterman says, indicated the true racial climate of St. Petersburg.
All he did was bring out what was already here. No way possible for that to come up overnight. You know, I'm not going to make him the bad guy. He just brought up from the depths what was already there. This is a divided city.
The division was apparent earlier this month during post-riot hearings sponsored by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Aside from journalists, witnesses, and members of the commission, very few whites attended these public forums in St. Petersburg's city council chamber. African Americans filled the room, and they spoke as if they'd been waiting for years for someone to listen.
4 years ago, you did change the chief, but you didn't clean out the department.
Whenever they arrest one of us, we just guilty as soon as we get picked up.
That's right.
It doesn't matter how it is, and it doesn't matter what you look like.
Since October 24th, we have had no rights in the African community. There has been martial law, and
please,
we are here tonight.
Continue to listen. Please help those who still are not listening.
Civic leaders have expressed surprise and occasional befuddlement over an outpouring of frustration and rage that has united radical and moderate African Americans. When a member of the Civil Rights Commission questioned Mayor David Fisher about a newspaper headline quoting one witness's assertion that our lives are in danger, Fisher replied that he didn't believe crime in St. Petersburg was that bad. Civil Rights Commission panelist Robert Ingram gently corrected the mayor.
So, Mr. Mayor,
yes.
The people weren't talking about their lives being in danger by criminals. They were talking about their lives being in danger by law enforcement officials.
Okay. All right. I understand that. Now I understand what you're saying. I'm sorry. No, I don't think so. I don't believe that.
The president of the Police Benevolent Association, the union representing most of St. Petersburg's police, wonders why he hasn't heard more formal complaints about alleged abuses of police power. And when it comes to African Americans' claims that police stop them for no reason except harassment, union president Jack Sewell says he's at a loss to understand.
I just can't fathom that we have police officers that would jeopardize their jobs, their careers, they're standing in the community just to stop someone for no reason at all. This is a very proud police department, and it's really hurt a lot of us. I'm talking about those police officers to be painted with this broad brush of racism because it's just not there.
One thing Sewell and most of his union do share with many African Americans is a deeply critical view of the current police chief, Daryl Stevens. But while many in the black community say police responded with undue force during the riots, the Police Benevolent Association claims the department wasn't adequately prepared. Two law enforcement officers were shot during the November riot, and the union has filed two lawsuits against the police chief, seeking more staffing, riot training, and equipment. Most whites who have spoken out since the riots have done so in support of the police. A few residents made hand-lettered posters and stood outside union headquarters for a few days. Others donated an estimated $10,000 to a fund for James Knight, the officer who fatally shot Tyron Lewis. Although a county grand jury cleared Knight, the police department suspended the officer without pay for 60 days because he violated department policy by standing in front of the suspect's car. When whites and blacks acknowledge that there are racial problems in St. Petersburg, they're often talking about completely different problems. And most white residents, historian Raymond Arsenault says, don't even get that far.
People here don't want to be bothered. So that kind of laissez-faire mentality, I think, encourages people to think, well, if there's no real crisis of the moment, then everything must be all right. And if you add to the fact that there's so much residential segregation where it can be out of sight, out of mind, then they can not feign surprise, but I think actually be surprised because they don't live in the same city.
There are some interracial committees and discussion groups, and journalist Peggy Peterman notes that a handful of whites in St. Petersburg have always been involved with African-American social and political movements. But she believes that for many whites, the price of involvement may be too high.
There's a lot of pressure and ostracism of white people who want to do right. I mean, they have good hearts, some of them, and they would come out fighting, but it takes a lot of courage. So I can understand a white person who says, hey, I'm here, I'm relaxing, I don't have to be bothered. But every time that happens, you can't contain it, because whatever happens to me is going to happen to you.
Whites and blacks will have a part in overseeing the distribution of an estimated $20 million in federal job training, community development, and housing funds allocated to St. Petersburg since the riot. But there's even disagreement over who will participate in that process. Many African Americans insist on the inclusion of the Uhuru People's Democratic Movement. Many whites blame that same black socialist group for inciting the riot. Even as they wrestle with these disagreements, most blacks and whites recognize that they have got to overcome them for the sake of maintaining the pleasant and carefree image that is the lifeblood of their city. After the October riot, tourism officials reported only 24 hotel room cancellations out of 16,000 bookings. Nobody wants to see it get any worse than that. Not the civic boosters downtown, and certainly not the service workers who staff the restaurants, shops, and parking lot shuttles on the St. Petersburg Pier. 70 years ago, the city's main pier was off limits to African Americans and Jews. 30 years ago, it became clear to tourism promoters that exclusionary laws were bad for business. Perhaps the same knack for public relations may prompt St. Petersburg to re-examine and perhaps abandon the customs that have outlived the laws. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting. ¶¶